I've turned the recorder on again, Stan. And could I ask you to go back a wee bit and tell me again about your first impressions of New Zealand when you arrived here?
You can have that one.
Oh, thank you. Stan's just given me a copy of an article he wrote on his wartime experiences during the Battle of the Atlantic. That's very kind of you. Thank you very much.
Well, it was written primarily for my granddaughters so that they would not have any false impressions of wartime events.
What actually
the
happened.
The truth. No gloss. Nothing's been glossed over.
Yes. Now, having come through all that and arriving in New Zealand in 1951 and then coming back again in 1952, is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yes, getting married, yeah.
I mean, what were your impressions of it at that time and how did people respond to you as a Scot?
Very well. You're a visitor to the country, and in New Zealand we found people were very easy to talk to. The values we had, the Scottish values we found, were very much the same here. I'd mentioned that I had two aunts, my mother's two sisters, in Auckland. I met with them. One of them was a widow. The other's husband was still alive at that time, a retired policeman. And I got on exceptionally well with these families. It was very lovely to see them. And in various places around, I'd caught up with, again, people of Scottish descent. In fact, in New Plymouth, there was a doctor there who had been, believe it or not, my father's patrol leader in Scouts in Ardrossan in 1909.
It's a small world.
A small, small world. And they had kept in touch over the years. And he was the Dr. Brown, Donnie Brown he was known as, and he had actually kept in touch with the Scottish side of the family, his parents and so forth, and they came home quite regularly to visit. So his two daughters were known to me from the mid-1930s, and they, one of them died a couple of years ago, but they were like sisters to me, those two girls. And I had a card from the other one just a few weeks ago, looking forward to seeing me, etc., what's happening. Just all the gossipy bits and pieces, family gossip.
Kind of thing. So these were good impressions.
These were good impressions.
Did you suffer at all from any of the negative stereotypes?
No, I found it that there were silly little things. When we were getting married and we started to look for a house to rent to start with, and then getting furniture together, and reading the newspaper columns, the for sale columns, you strike a phrase, well, let's say it's somebody selling a bookcase or a bed or something like this. First to see, must buy. And you look at that, and that is a command, isn't it? Must buy.
Yes.
But it doesn't mean that, of course, in New Zealand. It's just that the first person who sees it, oh, he'll be so enthralled with it, he will buy. Little phrases like that, and I get all sorts of bits and pieces. Another one was, ladies a plate.
Ladies a plate.
Now, this is a very common in New Zealand of yesteryear and today. A function, a community function or a friend's home there, in the notice there, ladies a plate. Now, the ladies took along a plate of either edibles for supper or whatever, that thing, and sometimes the men put a gold or a coin in or whatever it was. There were no gold coins then, but this was a common thing. But this ladies a plate, and I scratched my head over that, and there were lots of other small, small things, and I caused a lot of hilarity sometimes. My future mother-in-law and my wife-to-be, I fancy not knowing that. Silly little things, but this took a little bit of getting used to in itself. And I must admit that my accent was very, very broad at that time. And I got on sometime, probably a year or two after I arrived and settled in, involved in a national radio, with the Scouts, Scout Session. I was involved with Scout Session. That was a half an hour a month, and it was quite good. But I also did a series of tales, Children in Scotland.
Really?
This was just about Christmas in Scotland, and Hogmanay was there, and Christmas time, even in my younger days, and not even a public holiday in some parts of Scotland. And the little things, the Christmas trees.
You did that on the radio?
Yes, did this on radio. But when I heard it, I was aghast. It was so, so broad. So probably at that stage, I had to turn around and relearn how to speak the King's English.
And how did that come your way, that chance to tell those stories on the radio?
Can't think where it was now. It was probably through the Scout Session. I got to know the broadcasting people. And the young lady who was doing the children's hour at that time she was from Plymouth, and her father had been a sailor, and her husband was a cook here in the hospital. I think we got to know the family quite well, etc., etc.
So were these your own stories that you made up?
Yes, you made the stories up, yes. The odd little things about this and that, sort of events or whatever.
And are holidays like that celebrated differently here?
To a degree, yes. It's much more going away. What they call cribs in the North Island, or batches in the North, and cribs in the South. The holiday home at the beachside, just a little simple shed or a very, very simple house, and the family go there for weekends. And this was, everyone would go away for a holiday weekend or a holiday period. And this was just so different from Scotland, where a holiday meant people congregated in cities to be entertained en masse. But here, people rather went out to get away from the crowd.
And why do you think that is? Do you think it's the seasonal difference, or
it could be seasonal in some reason? But I think it's just being on your own, doing your own way. My late mother-in-law had a lovely little cottage with an acre of ground, and we spent our honeymoon there. It was a delightful place, and it was just. I'm trying to think of a little township called Waitati, just to the north of here, probably 25 miles to the north of here. The only way to get in was by train. So you told the train driver that you wanted to get off at Waitati. There was no station, no nothing, but he flew the train there, and you got off with your bags and bits and pieces, walked up to the crib, and family stayed there for lengthy periods over Christmas. And children amuse themselves, of course, wonderful playgrounds for these children. It's become a New Zealand way of life.
Do you know what I'm reminded of, though? The Bruins.
The Bruins, yes.
And the Button Ben.
Yes, yes, it's the same thing. I kept the Bruin cartoons for many, many years.
Did you?
I kept the selection of Scottish cartoons way, way back there. Get it for you before you leave.
Did someone send them to you?
I think I must have I don't really know. I can remember pasting in a book and it was year over the years. Some weird and wonderful ones.
There are Scottish newspapers and magazines on sale here.
Yes.
Yes, certainly
there
used
are,
to be.
Yeah. This is comparatively new. Prior to this, you'd wait for your local Scottish newspaper to be sent by relatives or friends or whatever. But after a little while, it ceases to interest you. You don't know the people we refer to in a newspaper story, or the events, or what's led to it, or the outcome of it. So it becomes a non-event. So that you very soon get away from reading what you call the local daily paper.
Did that happen to you?
Yes, yes, it did.
How quickly?
Comparatively quickly. The first page many New Zealanders go to is the Hatches, Matches and Dispatches, the Births, Deaths and Marriages. And that's a keyboard in New Zealand for people who know lots of people within the community, and it's important that they know who has gone, or who is married, or children, etc. It's all part of being a New Zealander. But in those days, it was probably just so to keep you abreast of what was happening on the wider scene. But it doesn't take long when you settle in a new place, when you read the local newspaper, cover to cover, you've arrived, you've settled in. You might have looked at it for the first month, the 2 months, 3 months, but by the time you read your local paper, cover to cover, and put it down satisfied with what you've read, then you're a native.
Yes.
You've arrived there.
Were you ever homesick?
No. Because I had been away from Scotland so long in those formative years that I had just no thought of Scotland, really. That was all there was to it.
With being at sea.
With being at sea and stay that last 4 months. The most boring 4 months of my life ever spent was the September to December 1951, when I did say to my mother, yes, I'll stay for Christmas, and didn't.
You didn't.
But I had an awful job entertaining myself during that time. That's when it was highlighted that my friends had all gone, and I knew nobody around the village. People had gone and just away, etc., etc.
Had they emigrated?
Yes, some had emigrated, I suppose. But it was a difficult period. I was looking back. I bought a car. I toured Scotland. On many occasions, I took my mother with me. We went to Edinburgh for a week. We went down into Glasgow and things. We did a lot of exploring, as it were, and to me it was my final look at Scotland.
So you sort of knew you were.
I knew I was going to want. I wanted to go away.
Must have been hard for your parents, though.
Again, I'd been away for so long. You see, before then, so they'd been so used to me. I was just a letter writer. That was all it was.
I was going to ask you, did your parents write to you once?
Yeah.
You'd settled here.
Great correspondence in there. In fact, the correspondence I have all the letters from the lady of the love of my life. I have all the letters I sent to her, and she kept all mine to hers. So I've got them stored away in a box for my grandchildren.
Oh, yes, they want them.
Yes, yes, they want them. To see that their granddad and grandma weren't all that stayed.
There is a long history of there being a public library in Dunedin.
Yes, oh yes, the Carnegie Library was here. There was, prior to that, the Athenaeum, which people rented books. And in fact, I have a few copies of books that came from the Athenaeum, and they were just picked up second-hand shop, not because of the Athenaeum, but the content interested me. And that bit, but the Athenaeum rubber stamp inside it, and it was there before the Carnegie Library came.
Right, that was a subscription library, yes, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah. So we were very lucky with Carnegie, all he did for people in these other countries.
The old Carnegie Library was in Moray Place.
That's right, yes.
Do you remember the first time you went in there?
Yes, it was very claustrophobic compared with Paisley Library. Very, terribly tiny, and you probably inwardly said, is this all there is? But you didn't dare utter such a scathing remark. You'd been tarred to the bound and feathered. However, you learned to keep your thoughts to yourself. That kind of thing.
Do you think you had to do that as a Scot?
No, it's not hard. You learn to see. You don't discuss. You don't discuss that. You don't discuss that. You live that kind of thing. You've been taught what not to do.
So do you think people would get fed up with you if you were always harking back to what it was like?
People did. I know I myself did. I used to say to my late wife there, I said, talk to so-and-so, she never gets homesick once. Gosh, she'd been for 30 years here. What's wrong with a woman? You know, I had this very scathing feeling of that. But there was a lot of people who were like that, just could not settle, and many of them went back. And I used to think of what the things that they missed going back. It's so very, very difficult.
Yes, Well, anyone going back then would have been going back to post-war austerity, wouldn't it?
It was very, very much that way. Because I remember Glasgow was being in very, very poor shape after the war years. You're only getting over things. It was utility clothing was still being made and still. It was still ration for this, ration for that. And going home, you were able to take fresh meat sometimes even, you know, if you could buy some aboard ship or do whatever.
Anyway, you joined Dunedin Library then, I take it. You did join.
It was very early in the piece. Very early in the piece.
And what sort of things were you taking out of there to begin with?
Basically, travel, I suppose. I looked a lot at travel, even though I had travelled extensively. I was interested in history and geography, as I still am. But just a good fact rather than fiction story. But my taste changed over the years as my interest widened in living in New Zealand until I've mentioned gold. I took up gold panning, gold fossicking, as we call it here. I was able to gather little bits and pieces of gold. In fact, my children in London, their wedding rings are from Grandad's fossic gold.
So you never sold it then?
No, I never sold it. No. And my little youngest granddaughter, a couple of years ago, two or three years ago, was doing a school project on gold. So I was able to give her a little capsule with some piece of gold in to take back to the class in London.
To take
my granddad
to the class.
Dug this gold up. And that way, and that was something quite unique in in there.
Well, that would make you something of an exotic figure. The gold speculator.
But later on, I came in that gold fossicking period. I went through a phase of sea stories. I used to groan, but my son, and growing up as a teenager, would, "Oh, I brought this home for the library for you now, and it's another wartime Navy story, another wartime," and you got fact mixed with fiction, and sometimes you just groaned at the fiction of it, or somebody trying to, you know, be clever to write a story. Very, very poor. So I went through that phase, and very soon learned to say, thank goodness, it's finished. But went on to local history then. And then I became very, very involved with local history. This was our right, goes to the gold fossicking. Where did the old miners find their gold? How did they find it? How did they get to this place? What were the signs of gold, the visible signs? The lay of the land, the contours, what was happening. So you read it very extensively on things. And you see from the bookcase you're looking at now, most of it is local history.
And where would you get your reading for that? You're right, it would have to be quite wide.
Well, you'd go, the library have got wonderful resources, and I still use a lot of their resources, because the books are being written by the hundreds, almost, it seems, on history now, old history. And I have, I'm friends with five published authors here in the historical field. And they've all did wonderful jobs of local history on particular facets of the business here. So it's a growing thing.
Good use of that library over the years then.
I have too, I have too. And I set out a project. The gold was found in 1861, a little place called Gabriel's Gully, about 45-50 miles from Dunedin here. And to get there, you walked. Well, if you had a horse, you took a horse, but that was it. Horses were rare. You walked. Or one fellow even tried to all his home possessions in a wheelbarrow all the way. Following on from there, the finds were quite rich, and it began to expand around that particular area, but more and more people came, and there were more and more duffer strikes, as they called them. Well, there was just a little gold, and it petered out very quickly. So miners started to go further afield, and by the time 1863 came, they'd branched out considerably in many, many directions. And there was one area called the Dunstan. Now, you possibly know the Dunstan of the range of mountains of Northumberland. Mm. They were given that name by the then surveyor who gave them the Dunstan Mountain. They reminded him of home, and this was what he called the Dunstan Range. Now, good gold, good solid gold was found in there, in the rivers, in the banks, etc., the whole way right through there. Now, to get to there, there was one way to get to there, that was to walk 105 miles, 5.5 days walking. There were no shops on the way, so everything you took, you had to take your food, and there was no shops up there, no nothing. It was just an area of vast open land. It had never been opened up a real civilization. It was populated, probably country the size of Scotland, had about 100 people in it. That was in those gold rush days. And these were people who had gone to open runs, as they called them, station runs. And they were running 4, 5, 10,000 sheep, because sheep runs. And people lived a very isolated life in these sheep runs. And some of the stories that we still have today are wonderful stories. They're real meat on the bones of a bare history. So the station, the run people, soon discovered that they could sell a carcass of a sheep. I think it was £1 for half a sheep. Cut it down the middle, and here's your half, here's that, and that was it. And then they found that their sheep were being salvaged, in inverted commas, by the miners, reappropriated, etc. So they put watchdogs on them and didn't allow them. But to get there was across fastless mountains, no route, no nothing, and it became called the Mountain Trail. And in my gold fossicking days, I became very interested in this there and started to look to examine the history, and I've gathered a great deal of history of that. I've been promising myself to write it for quite a long time, but it hasn't happened yet.
So this would be to write,
book on
bring together everything that you read and find out.
Let me just, if you mind leaving me for a second or two.
Stan's just brought me it's quite a large. This is a copy of an original map, is it?
I got a copy from there and I photographed the original. And I'm going to present this to them when I finish with it. They don't know that yet, but that's part of it there.
And it's a map that was produced and then sold to these gold mining prospectors.
Jock Graham.
In 1862.
Enterprising Scot.
Yes, indeed.
And he was known as Redcoat because when he took the mail to Gabriel's Gully down here, he wore a red coat and he had a bugle. And as he came over the hill, he blew his bugle to signify mail. Now, the bugle is still in the museum there. I don't know where his red coat went to, but that's it. But this is nothing genuine, it's signed by Red Coat.
And where did you come across this?
Well, this is from the Settlers Museum.
Right.
It's the one and only in existence. And I got permission from them to take a copy of it. Because this was to be the basis of the book basis. Now, this is the thing, you're coming up here, see from Dunedin, and you're just going to cross over here and up there like that. Now, this is trackless waste. Nothing.
And a long way.
Just a long way, 105 miles. And it was just slog. A lot of just gave it up back again.
But those ones who didn't give it up, it could be very lucrative.
They did very, very well.
Well, I'll put this here.
Yeah, just be there, yeah.
And
so,
we'll put it away later.
Yeah.
That's obviously something you got really interested in.
I'm very, very interested in it. I've done a lot of research on the thing, the project. I'm hopeful that I've got enough go left in me to do the thing there.
I should just say too, this is a house where there is a book in every corner. And you're a great collector, Stan.
Well, this is a collection of photographs of the Dunstan Trail, the Mountain Trail.
So you've gone out there and taken these photographs yourself. Mm-hmm. And annotated them. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's a terrific record.
Mm.
So there was some basic reading that you did first of all to get into this subject. Mm-hmm.
And for the way through, I've walked the whole of it, or photographed the whole of it. There's the type of country you're looking at.
Yes,
That's what the mind saw as I climbed the hills.
And Stan's just showing me a photograph here of a vast New Zealand sky. Taken from the hilltop above Rockland Station on the Dunstan Road, and this was the gold venture.
This is what they call the steep pinch.
Mm-hmm.
The stagecoaches ran 3 times a week initially.
Mm-hmm.
Now they had to take all the pastures out and they had to get down at the bottom and push the coach up with the 6 horses up here, the steep pinch it is called.
Mm-hmm.
And that's taken from the top here, when you're looking back on the salt pinch. Just an endless sky.
So I think the impression I get here is that you really became a New Zealander then.
Very, very much so. I've never changed my nationality, as many people have. I'm very, very loyal to the New Zealand ethics and way of life. I've enjoyed that.
Was there anything particularly appealing about Dunedin then, to you as a Scot who became a New Zealander?
Yes, it was, because I go back to the scouting thing. I was introduced to my boys-to-be the night I arrived in Dunedin, and saw a lot of her over the week's succession, because there was no work at the ship because of the strike. We wrote after this. I was home and wrote, and because coming back out again. But during that period of weeks and weeks, we spent a lot of time with lots of other leaders out at a camp outside called Waiora, Mary Wild Life and Health Giving Stream. This is the world's largest scout camp, 3,500 acres of scout camp. Now, we bought that in 1948. And it's been in a trust, and I'm one of the trustees of it there. And that is today a very wonderful place there. We actually sold 2/3 of it, funnily enough, in part of a Maori Treaty of Waitangi settlement thing. And we've kept about 1/3 of the area there. But kids can go there, camp to their heart's delight, go outside, do all the things, 11 miles from the centre of Dunedin City. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful place.
Now, the scouting movement, it's a very British thing.
Very British, but again international, the whole thing. And I had seen scouting in most parts of the world now. So I'm very privileged to have a background in that. And I was able to bring a lot of that type of thing to New Zealand scouting. So, as you see, it's an interest that grows on you all the way through. But I still love Waiora, and a couple of weeks' time we go to there to our annual. Well, old scouts have got a good club here called Baden Powell Guild. There are about 80 of us, and we'll go out a couple of weekends and enjoy the sunshine, sit there and have a barbecue and talk about old times and go around the campsite looking at what the kids are doing today and perhaps help them somewhere along the line, kind of thing. So it's all part of it.
Yes, that was one organisation that you joined. And you did mention to me off the recording the Burns Clubs.
The Burns Club, now, it was a very, very strong club when I came here with about something like 800 members. And they had monthly concerts, and they were splendid concerts with top artists. It had a very enviable place in the Dunedin history. The Burns Club was a very powerful club. All mayors were part and parcel of it, councillors, and prominent citizens. It was a very, very much an in thing to be there. The Burns Supper, the 25th January function, anything going like that. Now, the one man driving in those days was Bill Oliver. And Bill was very, very involved with Alloway, the Alloway Burns Club, mm-hmm. and the Scottish mm-hmm. side of things there. Now, when he died, the doctor, the thing there, the club went back and back and back. Mm-hmm. Today, I don't know anything about it, but I believe that it's very, very small mm-hmm. and struggling for existence.
Were you ever a member?
Yes, I was. I came back mm-hmm. to Dunedin in mm-hmm. 48, in 68, mm-hmm. intending to do two things. I want to be Master of my mm-hmm. Masonic Lodge, mm-hmm. and I want to be President of the Burns Club.
Right, well, their ambitions.
I managed the Lodge one, but I didn't manage the Burns mm-hmm. Club one. Mm-hmm. It had gone. Mm-hmm. And I just felt I was banging my head against mm-hmm. the door, mm-hmm. not getting anywhere.
What sort of things did the Burns Club
They were
Club
just
sponsor?
Doing the same thing, old things, mm-hmm. concerts, mm-hmm. but the calibre had gone mm-hmm. back. The people were very high in the committee to mm-hmm. organise things or do this mm-hmm. or do that. Mm-hmm. Was prior to that, it was just the top club in the country, in mm-hmm. the town. Mm-hmm.
And were there public readings at all?
Oh yes, all the way through. Mm-hmm. Very, very much so. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the old Scots, the generation before me, mm-hmm. and many of them First World War mm-hmm. people, were out here in various trades and occupations. Mm-hmm. They were the lights behind the mm-hmm. Burns Club, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and they did a marvellous job mm-hmm. of the Burns poems, recitations, mm-hmm. the whole way through. Mm-hmm. There was always somebody coming up with something new mm-hmm. to put on. Mm-hmm. So many an artist, this time for a major career mm-hmm. in theatre or song or whatever, mm-hmm. started off in the Burns Club.
Yeah. And I know you did go into the entertainment industry, for want of a better expression, yourself as a radio broadcaster the weather. An actor,
yes. But the influence, Burns has influenced an awful lot of people, I think. Mm-hmm. And the joke mm-hmm. about the two books that came in, mm-hmm. the old Scots kissed mm-hmm. the Bible and the copy of Robert mm-hmm. Burns, mm-hmm. may well be true, because there was a very, very devoted adherence, even at these earliest days, to Burns. Mm-hmm. We read it in the newspaper columns, we see it in the newspaper columns, that things were reported there. The fellow who lived in this house, Arthur Burns, mm. became president of the Burns Club mm. in 1892. Mm-hmm. And when I was cleaning one of these deceased estates, mm. I found the original minute book of the club mm-hmm. with his signature and all mm-hmm. the rest of it there. Mm-hmm. So it's quite
Do you think
amazing.
Your membership of the Burns Club did influence in any way the kind of career that you had?
Yes, probably it did, because what it gave me was a great deal of friendship, mm. a tremendous friendship mm-hmm. In the club and mm-hmm. the people in it, and it was very genuine. Mm-hmm. So for Mrs. Michael Honey said, "Oh, would you like to come for supper tonight or come mm-hmm. for some, mm-hmm. the afternoon tea?" It was delightful. It was social, mm-hmm. people met mm-hmm. with each other apart from the club noise. Mm-hmm. You saw what was going on.
And were these all other Scots, or
yes.
were they New Zealanders
no,
with the Scots
background? Very good mixture between mm-hmm. the two. Mm-hmm. Very good mm-hmm. mixture between mm-hmm. the two. One of our millionaires, believe it or not, was a member of the club, old Sandy McMillan. Mm. And Sandy was a dour old Scot who could never stop mm. clinking two coins together trying to make three out of it, you know? But he was the treasurer of the Burns mm-hmm. Club. Mm-hmm. And left them.
Well, a good job for him. Mm-hmm. A good job for him.
Yeah, yeah. So he was quite a delightful old fellow. Mm-hmm. And when I went to Invercargill, mm-hmm. he said he was a board member of mm-hmm. endless mm-hmm. organisations mm-hmm. and companies, mm-hmm. and he was on the board of what was called the Southland Meat Company, mm-hmm. frozen meat company. This is the big shippers mm-hmm. of meat overseas, and I'd set up my business in Invercargill, mm-hmm. And he knew I was coming here, so he always dropped in at morning tea. Mm-hmm. It was morning tea.
Right, so yeah. Social forum,
yeah, social.
But also could help you in business,
yeah,
I imagine.
Right, yeah.
Yes.
And uh-huh. My wife was saying he got on well. Mm-hmm. He'd come for a bill, and Sandy would always come for a bill. Mm-hmm. You know, they would always say he was the biggest bludger in creation, but he saved millions. And today we have the central city area where the Robert statue stands is Macmillan Terrace.
Yeah,
he gifted that to the city, part of his career. Yeah.
What do you feel about Burns yourself and his work?
A great deal of pleasure that I'm able to be part of it, to read it and to be part of it. And I feel a little closer to Burns because my family were Dumfries. And I know from holiday spent down there, and my father, Burns was also a great, my father was also a great fan of Burns. Mm. And my father took me around all the house and all the places of places that Burns had visited during his Dumfries days. So I felt I knew quite a bit about it down there, and Burns himself. I managed to get a Burns Club started in Invercargill. Was president there, but I shifted away from Health Hamilton. That was it. I don't think it lasted many, many years.
After you went.
Yes, that's right.
Do you still read Burns?
Oh, yes. Yes, it's there. There's always a number two book at the bedside. And if it's something I'm reading, the next one could be a book of poems, but the number two down below is always a book of Burns. And
Have you got a favourite? I know that's a hard question.
Yes and no. Tam O'Shanter's probably the favourite. And one wonders what he might have done given a longer life in coming into the storytelling and play, the play form like that.
Yes.
Because it is a superb story. And a wonderful story there.
Have you done much reading about the life of Burns?
Yes. Yes, I've done a lot. I've collected a fair bit of talking about Scottish memorabilia. This is something I want to ensure goes to a place where it's going to be made use of. That the book is spotted this morning, Little Glenriddle Manuscripts, the facsimiles of Burns' writings for the Glenriddle collection. And that is... worth something to a young student coming on doing things.
Absolutely. Now, you told me off recording too, Stan, that you did for a while the Address to the Haggis.
Yes.
And this became a business.
Yes. I got into it quite casually. There's an old chap called Bill Brown. He was one of the old fellas in the Needham Burns Club. Delightful old fella. Two of them in partnership, Brown and Turner, are painters. And Bill was good. And Bill was getting on in years. He'd say, oh, come with me. And he and I used to do Tam O'Shanter, paragraph by paragraph, alternating the voices, doing the whole thing. That was good. And then Bill would do the Address to Haggis, and then he said to me, oh, what about you doing this, and so forth. And he said, you know, look, I want your voice a bit of inflection this way, a bit more of this, helping, helping the other fellow out. So I got into it accidentally, and saw it grow into a very large tourism business. And it was a wonderful thing, because it was people I found from all over the world love Burns. And we told them the Burns story in plain language without any of the fanciness or any of the things. What, why, where, and use a bit of Burns poetry in the thing there. So it was a very successful business to do that. But unfortunately it lost its appeal because there were too many people trying to do it and copying and doing it badly, and unfortunately that's what happens with many things when people try to copy.
It's interesting how that association has grown between Dunedin and Burns himself, and the sort of perpetuation of the culture of Burns, you know, through the Burns Suppers and that kind of thing.
Yes, I became so well known I walked the streets of Dunedin when I was doing that burn thing because they produced a video promoting Dunedin and rather than just the sights and sounds of it, they went for some of the characters.
Right.
The characters of Dunedin. And there was an old fellow, Johnny Warren, who used to do the most marvellous fish, the enormous gentleman. And then with Johnny was a character, I was a character, waving this, doing that. Now that video sold the tourists coming and going and went all over the world. And I spoke to a fellow a month or two back there, and he said, oh, the last time, I remember now, he said, the last time I saw you was when I was in Berlin. And I said, looked at him, I said, I've been there for a while. And he said, no, he said, I was watching television one night and here you were on there. So we did that show for endless overseas televisions. We did it, you know, Japanese, Italian, German, French, you name it.
Good heavens.
Where we could, we'd change it to suit the language of the listeners. We couldn't exactly say the Burns one, but we'd tell them the story and the ferocious gesture that go with it. And the fun that's built into it in itself. And alternatively, we'd get an interpreter and tell the story through the interpreter. So you find that people have seen you all over the world.
That's quite amazing, isn't it?
And for a long time, I used to get a lot of mail, Christmas cards from people who'd seen me and do this.
You know, the Pacific world I can understand, but Germany.
Yes, Germany, yeah. And Italians and the Japanese and so forth. But it was, we went on, we performed out to large audiences. I can remember performing at the National Tourism Awards in Wellington, Wellington Town Hall. And there's 5,000 there, and I had them in the cup of my hand there. The audience, you know, the second you open your mouth on stage, whether you've got them or not. If you're not, you've got to be awful quick getting it back again. You know, let's get that way.
Now, you had two children, Stan.
Yes.
And what I'd like to know is whether or not you encourage them to read about Scotland, or indeed if you read to them the kind of things that you had read as a child in Scotland.
Yes, there wasn't very much of it in their younger days. Yes, I'd tell them the odd storybook story from Scotland. We've got a very clever artist here called, the character she created was Hayley McCleary from Nuddleton's Dairy, a wee black Scottie. And I'd mentioned she's written 17, 18 books now. Well, this was just a love of life, the young one, the daughter.
Is that a New Zealand author?
Yes, yes. Not Lindsay Hood. It'll come in a minute. But this was it. She's made a terrific thing, and that's worldwide. Harry McCleary from Donaldson's Dairy, and a lot of other characters, cats and dogs. Very, very funny, always lovely, and the illustrations were quite delightful.
These are Scottish names, but presumably it's a New Zealand setter.
Yes, always here.
And that's interesting. Here.
So the children, got stories from the books. I never tried reading Burns' poem to them, but my daughter grew up and got into poetry school. I'd say, this is a very lovely poem. Can I read it? And I'd read the poem. I said, in English. And you find when you talk to people, I couldn't read Burns, I don't know a thing about it. And you say, but he wrote it in English. He only wrote a few poems in the Doric. Oh, I didn't know that. And give them to the just try and think. And there's no knowledge of it. The sort of foreign language he wrote. And the number of people who said, oh, my uncle used to recite that in Gaelic. I'm sort of wondering. I don't think they ever did, because Tuath Hag was only translated into Gaelic in the 1950s, something like that. But, you know,
no, it doesn't really make sense.
They, the Doric.
Yeah, they're confusing Gaelic with Lowland Scots.
So that's interesting.
So
my son, he wasn't particularly interested. He absorbed the family story of the slaying of the Red Comyn, the behest of King Robert the Bruce, and that little anecdote, whether it be myth or fact, is hard to tell. But he's, strangely enough, in more recent years, and he's now in his mid-50s, getting to the point of thinking about retiring, he's a great reader of Scottish geography. So he knows now an awful lot more about Scotland than I do. In a geographical sense. So if you present with the book, say, oh, just read this, you might be interested in that. It's so-and-so, it goes up to the end, does this and does that. And he's got to, so he's interested in that. He is an amateur geographer, that's what his hobby is.
And it's interesting that he's looking at Scotland.
Now,
you've never been back.
No, I never had an ocean tour. I was offered free trips back from town to town, ships, people I would sail with, that want to come away as a supernumerary. I said, no, what would I go there for? But not the, I had not the slightest interest. When I came here, I just said, no, that's me finished.
So where did you go on holiday then, Stan?
When go on holiday?
Did you go anywhere on holiday?
Oh, yes, locally here. You went with the children. The children's good time. So you went to the beach resort, so you went to there, you went to that. And I was a keen fisherman, and my daughter became a keen fisherman and got nice, lovely, nice trout. But my son never ever took that up there.
Has your son ever been to the UK?
Yes, he's been going over quite regularly until his tum got the better of him. He hadn't been able to go for a few years, but he would go for a month, base himself in London, and set off with a good pair of sneakers on and a backpack and go to the bookshops of London.
All right. So he's a real reader too, isn't he?
He paid £400 excess baggage and books.
That's worse than me.
Well, you know, this is Robin. But you can see what he's got here.
I can see, yes. He has a vast collection. Again, mostly non-fiction. So you've perpetuated that from your own father and mother.
It's gone through the family. Yes, they've been. And now, with the grandchildren, the granddaughters, I've sat them down and said, now I would like to tell you a very lovely poem. It doesn't matter who the author is, anything about it, but some of the ones, tell them this or that next thing. And there, Katie is writing quite good poetry herself. She's up a sixth this year, so she's been writing quite well. And they've both been performing school plays and getting involved in that kind of business, so they're with Grounded to some extent there.
You've done a lot of travelling, and I know you like to read about travel, and you like to read about all the various hobbies that you've taken up, Stan, including meteorology.
There's endless hobbies. But my wife used to say, what next year?
But you have done some fiction reading, and you do have a love of poetry.
Yes.
So, in terms of contemporary fiction, do you read anything of that?
The nearest I'd probably get to it is fictional sea stories, perhaps. Something I know the background of. Somebody's written a fictional story about a tanker disaster. Now, you'll look at it as a seaman, you'll look at it very critically, you'll dissect it, and you'll probably shut the cover and say, well, I didn't really know what he's talking about. That kind of, treatment of the book, as it were.
And what about the historical seafaring tale?
Yes, I'm still interested in some of the Scottish historical stuff in itself. I can still sit down and read the Reader Digest condensed books to some extent. I can be selective, but have a look at them there, or even some of the Reader Digest short stories, particularly if there's a Scottish theme of them.
Are you still getting the Reader's Digest?
No, I haven't got it for years and years. No, we don't see it at all now.
So these are all back copies that you
and from yesteryear talking about it. But no, I only read it in a wishy-washy room or something. That's all these days.
Now, I did notice though in one of the other rooms that you had a pile of the Scots magazine.
Yes. Well, again, I've never contributed there. I've never been great, but Robin has conscientiously brought me that as he's gone past the shelf. So I've probably in the last 3 years, if not longer, read every copy as it comes through, just as a library book. And of course, those ones there were of Job Lot. I think he bought at a sale. As it turned out, I'd read about half of them. But I actually wrote to them last year sometime, I suppose it would be. A lady, don't know where, Edinburgh, had supposed to give them the story of the Gilbert Burns side of the family and their life in Edinburghshire, you know, down in Forfarshire, down there. And the way of life with Gilbert and the mother was there, Burns' mother was there, of course, to start with. Bun and Blair's the Gilbert's wife and his family growing. And she finished the article by saying that she understood there was a house built by Gilbert in Dunedin in 1848 when the settlers came here. So I wrote and pointed out that it wasn't the house was built for him, occupied by his son, and then it was 1866-67 and they moved into it. So just to correction that and bring it up, and I bought the house in a derelict state, I'd renewed it, so forth. I sent the pictures, but they didn't use them.
I was about to say, they didn't publish it, did they?
Scott's magazine. So it's in one of those ones there, I think. I've got a copy of it. It was just, you know, it was interesting. Nobody.
Oh, so they did publish your letter then?
Oh, yes, that was good. That was good.
Now, that's interesting that information is coming back to Scotland for a Scottish magazine.
Well, that's true, yes.
Isn't that interesting?
Oh, I can remember newspapers talking to one of the boys, and it was Campbell at the Glencoe. And I'd done a little bit of study on it, a little bit about it. So I wrote a short article for the newspaper, and did I get a deluge of mail coming in? This was right, this was wrong, etc., etc. And you know, almost what deodorant the fellow, the Campbell King, had used for that day and all that. Amazing the stuff that came out. The nth detail of it. So people were very conscious. I was amazed. But there are quite a number, and this is a more modern phenomenon, there are endless clubs, the clan societies here in Dunedin. And this has been, you know, it's a growth industry in more recent years.
Have you joined any of them yourself?
No, I've done any part in that.
What do you think about that?
Nothing wrong with it. Yeah. I'm proud of my heritage here itself. I think we all got to be proud of our heritage, where we come from, where we're going, and that our children internally are about that. So I've endlessly extolled this Kirkpatrick's of Closeburn to my daughters and told the story to my granddaughters, so that they in turn have some knowledge of what's going on. What's happening that way?
And you're keeping links with.
Yes, you're keeping that way.
New Zealand has its own heritage, both the settler one and also the Maori one. Before it, have you done much reading about?
I'm not a Maori fan. Appreciate what they're doing, what they're trying to do. I think there's an awful lot of dollar signs before the eyes today with anything to do with the word Maori. It seems to nothing happens with the, we want another 20 million, please. No, please, we want it. You have to give it to us. For the wrongs, the wrongs that they devoted onto the settlers, you know, chopping them, eating them, they don't seem to come into it at all. There's a lot of that kind of thing. So the Maori race has re-established itself politically and are becoming very strong. I'm sad to see it because I think this is the beginning of racialism coming in. A lot of it coming in. This is apartheid coming back again. You're getting that kind of feeling in the country. That they're divided.
Because do you think that's a
brown skin?
An unintentional byproduct?
When I announced that I was hoping to go and marry a New Zealand girl, 90% of my friends thought she was coloured. They had no knowledge whatsoever of that. Whereas I'd been brought up on fortnightly editions of the news of the Pink Page, the magazine used to come out with photographs, etc., etc. I can't remember, Dominion or whatever, New Zealand something. But the two aunts in Auckland used to send this to my parents.
So I can remember
my bedroom being scattered with the New Zealand themes. So I knew the words New Zealand in the early stage. I knew that they had sheep and horses and cattle, but not tell me much more about it. My father starts to tell me a bit more about it and come into it.
So there was that interest.
So that interest there in the family, interest there in itself.
Now, you came over here really at the end of empire, really. For Britain. But from what I gather, this was still a very British place in terms of allegiance.
Very much so.
The royal family, for example. Well, how did you feel about that?
I didn't have any real thoughts. I can remember pouring, when the Queen drove past, I was pouring cups of tea for the elderly and skirt uniform.
Oh, yes, of course.
Lined up there, we'd entertain the group of them, and it was a vacant site in town there, and we'd put chairs, we'd put them down, we got the, we brought the women from the homes and used ambulances, used everything to bring them in, and we were busy cups of tea with them.
So you had a job of work.
That was it. There was nothing to do. It didn't mean very much to me in itself.
Really?
No, I'd probably been, you know, never thought the crowd and the respect the crowd.
There probably were, I mean, I'm sure a lot of commemorative books and magazines and things brought out, particularly when the Queen has visited New Zealand. Have you ever bought any of those? Or read any of those?
Not really. My wife for a long time had a fascination with the royal family, but I think all the books went there. It wasn't a huge one of possessive. Just probably went to the way of all books, you know, finish.
Yeah,
that was it.
Well, you can't keep them all.
No, I've discovered that.
Contemporary New Zealand fiction, its star is rising, really.
I'm reading some very, very good pieces by contemporary New Zealanders. Morris G is a good author, who's written some very lovely books, and they've been produced on television for television.
Have they?
And this will be good, because you can see the thing there, and there's some excellent New Zealand-produced programmes. Really, really good ones. It's a way of life I've absorbed very readily, very easily.
It seems so,
I wouldn't go back to anything any other way of it. And I'm friends with the former harbour master. He and I were second mates together in the bank line way back in the 40s, late 40s and so forth. And I see a lot of Ralph, and we were both from Paisley. We both went to school within quarter of a mile of each other, did not know each other, we were both in Scouts at the same time, but here we are, we met up in Dunedin. And Ralph will drop in, he dropped in yesterday afternoon and blether to me and this, that, the next thing, catch up with what was going on. But we both agreed now that we got out of the Merchant Navy at the right time. I got out because two things. I wanted to marry, the first and most important, and the second was I'd failed my eyesight test. I couldn't go any further. So I'd have been left as a second mate or mate forever and a day, and it's been old mate, you know, working my days out on a coaster somewhere around in Britain until I was 70 or that kind of thing. But he got out, he went to South Africa, was there, then came here and was harbour master and pilot harbour master and so forth. And I was the same, I came ashore, and it was the best thing I ever did. Because all our contemporaries were out of a job.
Yes.
In the 1960s and then to the 70s, the container revolution started. And nobody wanted to know old soul thing of mates, who didn't know anything about containers, that type of thing. And it just became ridiculous. The Bankline had about 30, 40 ships. Now, they did keep one of them. Because they hadn't gone to containers,
right,
gone
then,
there.
Yes,
and we found that those people just coming ashore wondering what to do. And I had an amazing number of people sit there and sort of say, well, you want to drop, get up, off you do. What would you think you could do? And I'd say, well, you can do this, you can do that. Oh, no, Bill, that's, look, you're doing it every day. Let's say clerical work of some kind, doing this, or looking after cargoes. I do it. I say, you can adapt. You adapted to seagoing, you can adapt to shore living. So it's been an experimental journey the last few years, and I think we won with the container age.
Now I'm just looking to my right here, and I see you've got the Otago Daily News, which seems to be very popular.
It is a good paper. It's an extremely good paper. I actually cuttings from it every day. One lot goes to the grandchildren in London, who get a great deal from it. That and other magazines and papers. And I post them to them every week or 2 weeks. And also another set with the nautical side of it to my cousin, the Sulkus. And
he is not sending much, things back.
Sending things back, because he and Sulkus is not getting an awful lot of nautical things. He tells me the Clyde, it's rare to see ships going up the Clyde these days.
It is indeed rare.
He says, no, I said, I've got to go up Skelmorlie Way, up out there, to see the bulkers coming in to Hunterston. And he said, but there's nothing much more, he said, other than the Navy, the Green Funnel, the Grey Funnel line. He says, there's very little going through.
Well, and
so he's getting more shipping information than, you know, and he's getting local papers. That's all his.
Oh yes, I see.
Shipping.
And you post them every couple
of weeks? Yes, they're all posted. Snippety bits, piece of shipping. And we talk the same language. Sailor's language, you know. He's retired now. But he did 25 years in command of the ferries, cross channel, and then he hired to hoop for Holland, and they did Prestonart and Larne, latter years. But he's been retired for 50 years.
Stuff out to keep people back home.
Yep.
Well, home for me anyway.
Right, yeah.
In touch with here. Do you still stay in touch with politics and events in the UK?
Not at all. No. Not at all. You know, I would not with anything in the political line, I've lost completely. My son has worked for the Foreign Office. Occasionally I'll see what's happening in your little neck of the woods. He's on the World Bank British team, so he's travelling extensively with government funding for third world countries. He specialises in African nations, but has finger holds into the rest of the world. He's got an office in Washington with 70, 80 staff on it, so they're kept busy enough. So he spends a bit of time over there.
I just wonder, because it is a good paper.
It's a good one.
It
covers the international news, the local news. It's very
is
well
there enough
centered,
international news in it for you,
yes,
Dan? There is.
Yes. The fact that there was a hurricane wind in Venezuela or Berlin, had a huge snowfall. It's only of passing interest.
Right.
It doesn't matter very much to you.
That's interesting. So there's no one sending you clippings from the UK then?
No. Dot will send me bits and pieces. Mm-hmm. Stuart's pretty good for sending bits and pieces, mm-hmm. odd things he picks up here or there. They're good from that point of view.
So very big Scottish issues, for example, in the last 10 years has been devolution.
Yes, you see, now I can't come to terms with that at all because I don't know much about it. I saw the buildings in Edinburgh and I thought I shuddered a bit, I'm afraid, so I saw the buildings in.
It's very controversial.
Yes, he had the comments with it there. But you see, I remember Edinburgh, you know, when I went through to Edinburgh as a boy. The sergeant major, the senior sergeant major, was always a friend of my father's. You know, our girls, yes, 11th Battalion, you were the 8th, weren't you? You're 2nd to 3rd, you know? They all knew each other, they knew who they were. And I can remember in the castle, as a 9-10 year old, go around the castle yourself, boy, tell Sergeant Major Bertram sent you. And you'll collect you in any way you want to go. And be let into the crown jewels and all the rest of it, you know, the whole way through. To get into places, what do you do? Sergeant Major Bertram said I could come in. That kind of thing. So I had the run of the Blanket Castle. I go anywhere in the place with it. And the pair of them were sitting in the whiskey there, talking, fighting the Cambry and Baramonsh and all the rest of the places again.
So are you happy with your memories then of Scotland? You don't need to update them.
They were pleasant memories. They were pleasant memories. I took a battering when I went to sea, because I've mentioned that you've got that story and you'll find it's really hair-raising. As we went down the River Clyde that first night, we were putting the stores back into the lifeboats and the life rafts up on top. And by means of success, now all of those had been stolen in Glasgow.
Right.
And it was a culture there, theft and misdemeanour and pure skullduggery and all the rest of it. Not working, not doing anything, shutting themselves in a cupboard and smoking a game of cards. You could do nothing about it. But that was the Scotland I remembered going away from. And then I came back to it in the post-war years, having been away for a fair time, having seen many other cultures, came back there and found it full of white boys. You know, the gentleman with the rolled up trousers and the cavalcade coats and all the rest of it, flicked here. And it was black market, black market, black market.
Was that one of the reasons why you ended up went up sticks?
No, I was ready to leave. I would think, looking back, I was ready to leave. I'd have probably gone for another girl somewhere else if this thing had gone.
Well, you were a sailor.
I still never any girl I knew the worst for doing me, my dear. But no, I kept in touch with all the girls there and had no thought of marrying anything. And this was the first serious one. And Helen had actually had two of her very much loved beaus killed in the Air Force, both two pilots. She used to talk very fondly of them. And we both did. We'd discuss our old girlfriends. And in fact, I've welcomed some old girlfriends to the house here.
Yes.
And, you know, that was that's the kind of girlfriend they were. You could take your family and meet the husbands and
these
do that.
Girls have come from the UK or
Yeah, sometimes, yes. Yeah.
Or other parts of New Zealand.
Other parts, you see. But that was it. But there was nothing wrong with that.
No.
Anyway. But I think I was ready to settle. I got to the stage and there was the ship I was on, I wasn't very happy on her, and the captain of her, she was very poor, he did a very poor job with the whole thing, and I was ready to get ashore. So I made it there, and then I said to Helen, and I said, well, you know, will you come? And I didn't propose marriage until I got back out again, but, you know, that was the understanding.
Stan, you must be getting tired now. I've kept you talking.
No, I'm quite good because I've been sitting a long time and I'm usually popping up and down to do things, but I'm quite happy and it's been quite a treat.
Very pleasant for me too. I've only got two things really I'd like to ask you about and then we can finish. One of them is to ask you to speak specifically about certain authors to find out whether or not you've read them recently in Scotland or more recently here.
Well, Maurice G. comes here one in New Zealand. of the Scottish authors.
Some of the very iconic Scottish authors, apart from Burns and Walter Scott.
Yes, well, I still go back to that. I still read John Buchan. I'm a John Buchan fan, and I have to go down into the pit mm-hmm. in the library here mm-hmm. to get the old Buchans. Mm-hmm. They've got full sets mm-hmm. there, but they're not on public display. Mm-hmm. So I went through the whole lot, mm-hmm. and Rob was enjoyed them too.
Mm-hmm. You read them more than once?
Oh yes, mm-hmm. oh yes, and go back.
So where did you read them first time?
Probably as a boy, mm-hmm. schoolboy, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We were very fortunate, the teachers we had, mm-hmm. all of them spurred us on mm-hmm. to learn, to do this, to do that, mm-hmm. and it was a pleasant mm-hmm. exercise mm-hmm. going on.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you mentioned Buchan. He does come up a lot for people of your age.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So he was immensely popular, obviously.
That's right. Now, I got the DVD of mm-hmm. Rotterdam at the 39 Steps
yes,
here,
uh-huh.
and I can still watch that. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. That's good, that.
Have you seen any of the updated versions of the 39
Steps? No, I haven't seen any of the updated ones, but I'm just trying to think what I... I don't know what I've done. But what I bought was a Kidnapped. I got a DVD of Kidnapped Peter, the Australian fellow, Peter Joyce, Finch, mm-hmm. playing the role of Alan mm-hmm. Breck. Mm-hmm. I thought it was good. Mm-hmm. It was the best, I think it was a Disney one, mm-hmm. but it was the best of all things. Uh-huh. You see the other ones occasionally thing coming up, Kids Fergus, I think, oh, not nearly as good as that Disney one. Mm-hmm. It was really good.
Interesting, Robert Louis Stevenson, have you read more widely of Robert Louis Stevenson?
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. I visited his home mm-hmm. in Vailima, mm-hmm. in Samoa, went out of a taxi and mm-hmm. slung my way up, the three of us. To get up there, you've got to climb up. Mm-hmm. How they got an iron coffin up there beats me. Mm-hmm. But they must have all tough fellas. Mm-hmm. And they must have, the journalists have rode up something. Mm-hmm. But getting up there was quite a job, and there were some mammy girls who took us up. We got up there, and I've got photographs taken of me on the grave, and I've been down to the house to Vailima, and itself, and again I've followed his wanderings, which will be through, and of course all these stories.
What about things like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde?
Yes, read it, but not with great interest. Mm. It's always sort of ghoulish in itself that mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. Scottish stories, even some of the older writers in the Scottish Scots magazine, some quite interesting stories to be told.
Mm-hmm. You know? Well, I mean, some of the sort of iconic ones are people like Neil Munro.
Yeah, or Parahandy. Yeah. Well, I've given Parahandy, I've got a copy of the vinyl mm-hmm. spot there, and uh-huh. I keep meaning to ask my cousin and Solkus, was a DVD ever made of anything mm-hmm. with a vinyl spot? Do you know mm-hmm. anything of that?
I'm sure it has, and I think actually the BBC have one, because they did some updated ones in the last 10 years.
There was one funny one mm-hmm. on television many years ago. An American trying to get goods from A to B, and he stuck a vital spark skipper, and he with his things, and it was the old story, the boat had gone the wrong way, we'll have to go off here for the night because it's so and so.
Was that the one with Burt Lancaster?
Yeah, yes, that's the one. Yeah, it was very, very funny, that one. But I've delighted that. Mm-hmm. I've given it to many of the associates in the American mm-hmm. world here, mm-hmm. But they can't get the library, the language of it. Mm-hmm. They can't get the gist of it there. Uh-huh. But I love Parahandy there.
Yes.
Quite delightful.
And, I'm sure next time your son's in the UK, you should be able to get a BBC DVD of
Parahandy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But D.K. Broster's another name that comes to... Some of the old Scottish historians, the fictional historians, mm-hmm. I remember being very entranced with Bothwell, Ford Brooks and Bothwell.
And trying
to work out what actually happened and why and what for.
Like Nigel Tranter.
Nigel Tranter. Mm. Now, do you know The Bridal Path?
No, I don't, no. I haven't read
you
much.
You haven't read The Bridal Path?
Shocking, isn't it?
What are you going to do for the next half hour?
Why?
I'll show you The Bridal Path.
Right.
I'll guarantee I can give you the best laugh you've had. Virginia McKenna, Bill Travers, and a very, very large school of Scottish actors, some of whom I know, are in the thing. But it's the most delightful tale. Now, spoiling it, the basic tale is he's sent to the young fellow's farmer, isolated. He doesn't want him to get married into the consanguinity argument, and they send him off to the mainland to get a wife. Well, and he gave a list of what he's supposed to do, what not to do. She must not be a Campbell. Well, he keeps running into these girls. Another bloody Campbell. It's like the whole way through this. And it was to be, we saw it, my wife and I saw it, early, early married days. And we laughed and we laughed and we saw it again. And we always just said, oh, we'd love to see that again. And I got a copy just before she died. And we laughed and giggled our way through like a couple of teenagers. It was really quite delightful. And the other one is Peter Sellers, The Smallest Show on Earth. Do you remember the title?
No, I don't know.
Well, one of very early Peter Sellers. Margaret Rutherford, Bernard Wiles, Peter Sellers, and Virginia McKenna, and Bill Travers again. And they inherit, rightly or wrongly, a cinema. But it's not the big...
That sounds familiar now.
The Roxy or something down there. Weird and wonderful. The life, the humour in those things, absolutely marvellous. And Peter Sellers as the drunken projectionist, you know, with his bottle with the films going all the way. Quite good. So these are things I can get enthusiastic of them even after all of these years. I can still we'd be proud to be a Scot for those things here.
Are you okay? We had a wee break there just for 2 minutes. And I have one last question to ask you, Stan, but this is quite a hard one. Although you probably won't find it difficult. Which is to sum up for me, if you can, what reading has meant in your life.
Well, I think it's a fairly easy one. It's meant a great deal to me. It's probably my top hobby. Before anything else, I would be absolutely lost without books. I can remember once in the Mediterranean during the Italian campaign, we were bringing supplies up from North Africa to Italy, and we ran out of cigarettes. Now, that cigarette death of cigarettes caused more fractiousness and trouble on board the ship than ever, and somebody at times said, well, at least we've got books. I've never forgotten that episode. We couldn't get cigarettes anywhere, but there were still plenty of books to read, you know, to do this and do that all the way through. Not that we had an awful lot of time for reading in those conditions, but it was a bit sticky at times. But however, that's it. And I'm glad I've been able to continue what started by my parents, and I hope that I've influenced my children in the same way. I'm thrilled that my granddaughters are very avid readers and are carrying on the tradition, and both my children are very, very good readers. So at least I've passed the flag on for the next generation. But I wouldn't be without books. I wouldn't know where to turn or what to do, and my lack of information and knowledge would just be a bottomless pit, I'm afraid. I wouldn't know anything.
I can't resist asking you, Stan.
Mm-hmm.
Can you recall what you read when there were no cigarettes?
When I was in...
When there were no cigarettes on that occasion.
Cigarettes. No, I can't remember, but again, it was just the mission to see him and stuff being passed around, just that and the next thing. And there was always something to read, and it took your mind away from the cigarette one. And I can remember the finish of it there. I remember that I had, my father had been there 4 years in France, had always spoken about the Caporal, the French cigarette, and how strong they were and how lovely they were. And I remember I bought several packets for him in Algiers or somewhere we'd been, and put them away, and I remember I had them, and I brought the several packets out, and I advised them all among the ship's company, and we're nearly all sick with these strong smelling cigarettes, the so terrible smell of Caporal. So I was in the black books of everything, my cigarettes. There you are.
That was a sneaky last question. But I had to ask you. Anyway, I think we'll finish there, but not before I thank you very, very much, Stan, for being so hospitable to me this afternoon, and for the benefit of all your wisdom. I'm extremely grateful.
Lovely having you. The cord of memory stretches far in time, so I get somebody like yourself coming with Scotstown. I can drop back into it. I mentioned my friend, the harbour master here. He is a Scots wife. Mm. And we just blather and blather and blather.
Blather, there you go, that's a good Scots word.